Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, March 11, 2014. We've got some serious, important stories today about the CIA, about Guantanamo, about the NSA, new questions about the Boston Marathon bombing. So if you'll indulge me, I'd like to start with a story that is not crucial to the nation, but it's important to your humble host. The restoration of constitutional rule here in Marin County, California. That's where I'm based. It's where I live and work. And for more than 4 years, I have made myself a royal pain in the ass to elected officials here in the county and in the largest city, which is also the county seat, San Rafael. San Rafael installed some red light cameras over 4 years ago. 10,172 people have received $500 citations for failing to make a complete stop at one of two intersections near the 101 freeway in downtown San Rafael. Now, not only is the penalty way out of proportion to the crime, $500 for a rolling stop or a missed light, I think that the whole system of using red light cameras is arbitrary. It's using hearsay evidence instead of the testimony of a police officer. And it proved very hard to sustain the convictions, at least on the part of people who were smart enough to contest them. Most people just paid the $500 and moved on. But state law was undermining the use of these cameras. And I want to commend the members of the San Rafael City Council who endured my repeated questions. I co-host a local cable access show here in Marin County called Marin Voices and Views. You can find it on the web if you're really curious about it, marinvoicesandviews.com. And over the course of the last 4 years, every time a member of the San Rafael City Council or a candidate for that council came on the program, I would insist on asking them about the red light camera program, to the chagrin of my co-host, Larry Strick. But about a month ago, I was at a council meeting on another matter, and during a break, the mayor came up to me and pulled me aside and said, "Peter, I know you're going to love to hear this. We've canceled the contract for the red light cameras." Woo-hoo! So, it's not a personal victory. My angst over this was not the only reason that they decided to kill the program. It was getting declining returns. In the first year, 4,200 people got caught by the red light camera. Then it declined to 3,100, then only 2,300 in 2012. So people caught on that Big Brother was watching. And so this is a pattern that's playing out across the state. Los Angeles County has banned the cameras. Communities in San Diego County have removed them. And it was a misguided revenue generator that was embraced by Governor Schwarzenegger when he was busy bankrupting the state just a few years ago. So I'm pleased to be able to share that moment of victory with you. The Malaysian plane missing over Vietnam or points nearby is still missing. And last night I was amused to watch all kinds of coverage where the talking heads had to repeatedly say, I don't know. But the hosts of the show kept asking them questions. Well, what if it's a terrorist? What if it's this? What if it's that? The fact is, we don't know. And I will comment on the story when there is something to comment on. If you're a regular listener to this podcast, you know that I am a sharp critic of Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. I've known Feinstein since she was mayor of San Francisco in the 1980s. And while I respect her, and I do concede that she's a very smart woman who appears undiminished at the age of 80, I have been very critical of her management of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which she has chaired since 2009. She's been a cheerleader for the gross violations of our constitutional rights. Her idea of oversight was to send staffers to watch videos of drone strikes after they had already occurred and then say, yeah, that was okay. But finally, by Dianne Feinstein's own statement today, she has reached a critical turning point. And how she handles this conflict with the CIA and the charges and countercharges that we'll get to here in just a moment, I think will be the defining moment of her service in the United States Senate. And I say this without great optimism that she's going to do the right thing here. But her ego, her legacy are on the line. She is backed up against the wall. The CIA has leveled accusations at staff members who report to Feinstein at the Intelligence Committee, essentially that they stole a document, the Panetta Internal Report on Torture, as they were authorized to review documents at a secret location controlled by the CIA in Northern Virginia. This went on for months, years, in fact. Some 6 million documents were reviewed. And these documents were just like dumped out on the table. In a lengthy floor speech today, Feinstein explained that they didn't have an index, a list. It's just, oh, here's a memo, here's a memo, here's an email, here's a cable. Go for it. And what it boils down to is that the Senate Intelligence Committee no longer trusts the CIA to be honest with it. And frankly, we've seen the spy community lying to its minders and to the FISA court and caught at it, unpenalized, for years now. So it's hard for me to be real generous to Dianne Feinstein, because she's a smart enough old coot that she could have figured out quite a while back that she was being played and lied to by the very people that she so richly defends as they violate our constitutional rights in pursuit of this mythology of protecting us against the next terrorist attack. And so it's gotten personal. Feinstein, John Brennan, the CIA director, offering contradictory accounts of what's gone on. And what we clearly have is rogue spy agencies. We'll get to the NSA in a couple of minutes here. But Feinstein has finally realized that she cannot trust the people that she has been way too trusting of. And, quote, calling the present conflict a defining moment for the oversight of American spy agencies, Feinstein forcefully denied that committee staffers had obtained the internal review improperly. And she accuses the CIA of gaming them, of giving them documents and then disappearing those documents. And keep in mind, the staffers had to travel to this CIA-controlled office. It sounds like it's not at Langley. It's at some office park in Northern Virginia, and they set up a skiff, a secure room, and it included a computer that the staffers were allowed to use and that the CIA promised not to spy on. But because of this internal Panetta report, whose findings apparently agree with the central findings of the Intelligence Committee's critical report on torture, rendition, detention. And Feinstein does appear, to her credit, to be fighting to get at least a declassified summary of this report released to the public. It's been finished for over 14 months now. And clearly the CIA has been holding it up. Brennan admits as much, that he doesn't agree with some of the findings and he feels it might expose sources and methods. So now Feinstein has acknowledged that her staffers, who made a copy of the Panetta memo and took it with them from the skiff controlled by the CIA, that a redacted version of that memo now lives in a safe controlled by the Senate Intelligence Committee. We know it's in the Hart office building. And Feinstein said it was necessary to keep a copy of it because it corroborates critical information of the committee's own investigation and because of the CIA's history of destroying records about torture and detention, like the videotapes. And it's very interesting because Feinstein did not call out Robert Ettinger by name. But she described him in a way that leaves no doubt about who it is. She said the acting general counsel at CIA was previously a lawyer in the CIA's counterterrorism center, and that his name is mentioned more than 1,600 times. He was the guy who approved torture protocols, is what we can infer. So, as you know, while, you know, I don't celebrate misery and conflict, I think that this food fight that's underway right now is really important. And I think it could lead to the break that I have been seeking. Because ever since Russ Tice told me and Sybelle Edmonds last June after Ed Snowden surfaced that he had participated in wiretapping Dianne Feinstein in 2004, and Barack Obama and members of the Supreme Court and members of the FISA court, other top leaders in the Senate and the House, I have been waiting for her to respond to that. Because the pit bull that she loves to feed and stroke and coddle has bitten her more than once. And this very public spat with the CIA is the strongest case of this that we have seen so far. And so I welcome this fight. And it's not only a defining moment for whether or not our elected leaders can control the rogue intelligence community, but whether or not Dianne Feinstein is up to the job. And I think she isn't. But she has an opportunity here to prove me wrong. And my hope is that that will occur. But her speech on the floor today, I read every word of it. The Guardian published it, and I'll put a link to it in the show file at peterbcollins.com. It's worth reading. She goes into great detail about the terms that she had negotiated for the review of all these documents and how the CIA broke them several years ago, and she's still waiting for an apology and an explanation. Didn't explain what the specific issues were there. And she also wrote a letter to Brennan on January 23rd of this year and says she doesn't have an answer to those questions so far either. And she regards the way that the CIA has sicked the Inspector General and in turn the FBI on the staffers of the Senate Intelligence Committee as an effort at intimidation. Quote, I view the acting general counsel's referral as a potential effort to intimidate this staff, and I am not taking it lightly. Now, one thing I'll tell you about Dianne Feinstein. She's tenacious. She's also a micromanager, and she can often get sidetracked into trivialities. This is not one of those. And I hope that she is tenacious and she sees this through. And it's okay with me if this is driven by her ego and her concern about her own personal legacy. Because if that's what it takes for her to stand up and fight for my constitutional rights and yours, I'll take that over inaction any day. Now to the NSA, where the Senate Armed Services Committee conducted a hearing and lobbed softball questions at Michael Rogers. Now, we have to be clear here in the spook community because there are two Mike Rogers. One is a former FBI agent, Republican from Michigan, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee. He's the one who keeps suggesting that Ed Snowden is a Russian agent, which is all bullshit. We know that. But this guy we're talking about is Vice Admiral Michael S. Rogers, the nominee to run the National Security Agency and the Cyber Command. And it's the Cyber Command part of it that requires confirmation by armed services, and that's why he went before that committee today. And while he offered some buzzwords about being more transparent and that he would assure a sense of accountability, what does that mean? A sense of accountability? I don't need a sense. He dodged most of the important questions, and I don't, from the news account, I don't see that any real tough questions were tossed his way. And of course, like every other nominee, particularly when it comes to military and national security, Mike Rogers is going to be confirmed with a huge majority. And it's the failure of the Senate committees during these confirmation hearings that have left us with a lot of boneheads running government departments. I mean, you just look at the confirmation of the last handful of CIA directors, NSA directors, the FBI director. They don't ask any tough questions. They don't make these people promise to operate in an honest and transparent way. And that failure of oversight we see in very stark outline now with the Senate Intelligence Committee and its battle with the CIA. Now, regarding NSA and its collection of the millions of phone records of innocent Americans, a federal judge here in San Francisco yesterday, Jeffrey White, ordered that phone records that the NSA is currently holding that relate to an invasion of privacy lawsuit that is currently before Judge White must be preserved. Now, this is a very interesting and ironic situation, because previously the NSA only held records like this on innocent people for 6 months. Then in 2012, a committee of staffers in the Obama White House just arbitrarily decided to extend that from 6 months to 5 years, which is the current standard. And the judge is saying he wants them to preserve records for longer than 5 years because he wants to be able to use that evidence to see if people were improperly spied upon by the NSA. So this is the first time I will come out in favor of saving these bits of data that never should have been collected in the first place. And you may recall, if you heard our interviews with NSA whistleblowers Bill Binney and Russell Tice back in, I think this was October, we did a whole podcast just on the question of why Ed Snowden was able to grab so many documents without being detected, and that the NSA itself could not even tell you how many he copied. And Tice and Binney both told me that the NSA had intentionally not put in the kind of basic tracking software that any webmaster installs at any routine website. And the best example I can offer is that anybody who has a key card for the place where they work knows that every time you swipe that card, a computer makes a record that you went from point A through door B to point C. And they know it was you, and they know what time that happened. That kind of fundamental monitoring of the systems at the NSA was intentionally left out. And Binney and Tice told me it was because they feared that it would provide evidence that could be used to convict NSA officials. Well, now, stung by Ed Snowden, the U.S. intelligence community is planning to use sweeping electronic systems to continually monitor workers with secret clearances. And that is news. I mean, Snowden was tweaking them when he made the video appearance in Austin at South by Southwest. They forgot to guard the back door. Well, at Fort Bragg, the court-martial trial of Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair is now officially on hold. The judge sent the jury, the jury is comprised of generals who are on active duty, and they were told to go back to their duty stations while the two sides enter intense negotiations around a plea bargain. And the judge in the case, James Pohl, has suggested that there may have been some unlawful command influence. And what's hard to figure out from here is whether that influence was improper because it continued the case to trial instead of settling it. And the two issues were that Sinclair offered to take a plea bargain and that the complaining witness, the captain who claimed he forced her to service him, said, you know, we want to go to trial. And in those exchanges of emails were discussions of the politics of the moment with the Senate trying to pass legislation. They finally approved the watered-down McCaskill bill yesterday, but legislation related to the handling of these sex assault cases. And so what remains unclear to me is whether the judge is accepting the assertions that the complaining witness has problems, okay? She is accused of being dishonest about some of the evidence that she's offered. But I think that should be heard at trial. I don't think that should be settled, particularly since they've come this far. So, obviously, I'm not in charge here. But I think it's very curious that at this late stage, the judge has put the trial on ice, and we'll see if they are able to work out a plea bargain. I, again, would prefer to see the case heard and let the chips fall where they may. John Eisenberg is an attorney who handles appeals, and one of the appeals he recently won was at the appeals court in Washington, D.C., related to the right of hunger-striking prisoners at Guantanamo to refuse food and not to have to submit to force feeding. And John Eisenberg does a lot of great legal work. He's been on our program many times. And I am pleased to say that the case is now moving forward in a federal court in Washington, D.C. Was brought on behalf of a Yemeni prisoner who, of course, was cleared for release in 2009 but is still there. His name is Imad Abdullah Hassan, and he has been intermittently hunger-striking since 2005 and more or less continuously since 2007. And get this. They estimate that Hassan has been force-fed more than 5,000 times. It's a brutal procedure, and I think I've shared with you that after a car accident once, they put a feeding tube down my nose. It was one of the most excruciating things I've ever had to experience. And the first time they did it, I ripped it right out of my nose. I couldn't stand it. And one of the really cruel practices at Guantanamo is that they require that each time they force feed somebody, they put the tubes in and pull them back out. And lawyers have said, well, look, you know, you could just leave them in because it's the insertion and removal that is extremely painful to the prisoner. Also, they give the prisoners a laxative at the same time of the feeding, which causes them to have a bowel movement while they're in the restraint chair, and they soil themselves, and they leave them in their own shit. It's just barbaric. And we claim that we have the right to overrule the choice of these prisoners to keep them alive for the purpose of not charging them, trying them, or releasing them. I can't think of anything more barbaric in the human experience. And that's what our government continues to do. Jason Leopold, a friend of this program and a freelance reporter who is now writing for Vice online. Their website is news.vice.com. Today, he published a story based on another Freedom of Information Act request. He got a hold of the new standard operating procedure for force feeding at Guantanamo. And he learned that hunger striking has a new, you know, Orwellian euphemistic name. In the document that used to repeatedly refer to hunger strikes, they have, copied, pasted, and removed all of those and replaced them with long-term non-religious fasts. Leopold writes, the rebranding appears in a 24-page document with the equally ingeniously misleading title, Medical Management of Detainees with Weight Loss. And as Leopold has shown us in his writing in the past, these practices conflict with the ethical obligations of medical professionals who are ordered, because they are members of the military, to violate those ethical standards and force feed these prisoners. And Leopold tells us that the standard operating procedure document turned over today contains entire pages that are redacted. The introduction advises medical personnel what the protocol is for beginning force feeding, which is described as enteral feeding, but it doesn't contain a description of the restraint chair protocol that was described in vivid detail in a previous document. I'll link to this story, which includes a chilling photo of one of the restraint chairs that is used to force feed prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And finally today, I want to commend the continuing investigative work of Russ Baker at whowhatwhy.com. Russ has been on our program many times. He's a very serious reporter. And from the beginning, he and his colleague Dave Lindorf were skeptical of the stories that were floated into the media by anonymous government officials following April 15, 2013, the Boston Marathon bombing. And we've talked to Baker several times over the past year, Lindorf as well. And the latest story is really important. I'll link to it, and I hope you'll read it. Because, as Russ Baker tells us, there's only one witness, and we don't even know his name. He is called Danny. And we're told that Danny had his car carjacked by the Tsarnaev brothers. They drove him around Boston, and they bragged to him that they had conducted the bombing at the marathon and that they had killed the MIT police officer. And in a very careful examination of what we know about Danny and his testimony and his evidence, there are a number of holes. There are multiple versions that contradict each other about how long he was with the Tsarnaev brothers, exactly how he escaped from them. And we still don't know who Danny is. And according to Baker, Danny's testimony is not mentioned in the official indictment of the surviving younger brother, Jokhar Tsarnaev. And so I won't belabor this by going through it point by point, but there are important issues that the media and the government have failed to address in the shifting kind of corrective process of reconciling the original reports with the sanitized government version of what occurred. And because we have a lapdog media that has already just accepted that the Tsarnaev brothers were responsible for the Boston Marathon bombing, and let's move on to Justin Bieber's latest incident, these are critical questions. The way the government responded, the lockdown of Boston, the muscular federal response, the history of the older Tsarnaev brother, Tamerlan, his connection to CIA and FBI handlers, his trip to Russia just about a year before the marathon events, all of these raise more questions than they answer. And once again, the corporate media has not shown any willingness to challenge the official narrative, to conduct its own original investigations, and to inform the American people about what really has occurred here. As we wrap up today, I want to thank the people who support the Peter B. Collins podcast. I usually do this a little earlier, but I've been wrapped up in all the stories that we've been covering. David Radcliffe just renewed his annual subscription. Thank you, David. Ira Scott recently renewed for a year as well. And I thank Jeffrey Gill and Kevin Beckley. They are monthly subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Will you join them? I'd like you to, because I need more support to keep this going and to cover all the expenses. Yesterday, we acknowledged the people who have been very generous to help us with our audio upgrade here at the Secret Studio. But I need ongoing support from people like you. So here are your options. Go to peterbcollins.com. Follow the sign-up link under my picture. You can get a 24-hour pass for a dollar. Our monthly cancel-anytime subscription starts at $5, but you can press up to 10 or 20 if your budget permits. The best deal is our $50 annual subscription, and new annual subscribers in the continental U.S. get your bonus gift, and Diane Salazar, your package is on the way. Your bonus gift includes a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans and our latest bonus offering, the rock and roll CD called Red Flag by John Dist. The other way you can support us is by going to peterbcollins.com and following the link over to Audible. Audible will set you up with a free one-month trial subscription, give you a free audiobook download right off the bat, and you can continue to try it or you can cancel before 30 days and you won't owe Audible a penny. But for my referral, Audible will pay me $15 because you tried out their service. It's a win-win-win-win-win scenario, and I hope you'll click on over and help us out that way. Thanks for joining me today for news and comment. I remain your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.